From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made in Baltimore in 1962. A group of African-American children wanted to go swimming, but swimming pools were segregated. And so an 11-year-old boy named Elijah decided to do something about it. He convinced other Black children to join him in demonstrating publicly. Elijah teamed up with the NAACP to lead the push for integrating the public pool. It wasn't easy. As the Associated Press reports, every day for a week, when the Black children tried to get into the pool, they were spit upon, threatened, and called names. Years later, Elijah remembers being cut down by a bottle thrown from an angry crowd. That week changed his life. Elijah Cummings was the son of sharecroppers who would go on to become a lawyer, then a representative at the state level in Maryland, then an elected official in the United States Congress in 1996. He became a towering figure in the fight for civil rights and one of the leading voices in the push for African-American representation on the national stage. Congressman Cummings died yesterday from challenges related to longstanding health complications. He was 68. Political leaders from all backgrounds have praised him and his career. In this hour, a conversation about the legacy of Elijah Cummings and the importance of African-American representation in government. I'd like to welcome my guest for the hour. Larry Knox is a political and community engagement coordinator for 1199 SEIU. Welcome to you, Larry.
Thank you.
Michelle Daniels is a super Democratic volunteer. Welcome back to Rochester, Michelle.
Thank you.
Here for a brief time. Paul Hippolyte is here. He's a political strategist. Welcome back to you.
Thank you.
Tiana Mignon, my former colleague, is here. Hi. Publicist, journalist, and political analyst. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Robert Hoggard is here, doctoral student at the Warner School of Education and development associate at Rochester Regional Health. Welcome back to you.
Thank you so much.
We have a lot to talk about this hour, and we'll explore the impact Elijah Cummings' career has had from multiple angles, of course, but I'd like to start by asking each of my guests their thoughts on his passing. I'll start with you, Tiana. How did that hit you, the news yesterday?
Of course, it was really sad. I think what really stands out to me is that this was living Black history. So much of when we think about Black history, it's older but this was that direct link to everything that we talk about in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, even into the 80s. But I think what really saddened me was that he literally worked until his death. Like, he never got a chance to retire. He never really got to, you know, not rest on his laurels, but actually enjoy that old age. And so for me, you know, I see him as definitely this amazing Congress, but I also see him as this person who literally worked until his death.
Mm-hmm. Larry, how about you? How did the news hit you?
It was very sad. I mean, the first thought I had when I heard about his passing was, I remember the last time I saw him on TV when the president's attorney was testifying, and that last, 9-minute closing he gave, which was, patriotic, emotional, very real about how our country need to be better and how he felt for Cohen's family. And he had the story about the braces when he was, holding his, seeing his daughter, and it was just very emotional. So my first thought was, that decency that is so often lacking in our politics. And here was somebody who was, on the grandest stage displaying that earlier in this year. So I just remember that loss, not just for being African American or being a Democrat, but just for, our political discourse that somebody like him is no longer here.
Michelle.
I felt shock for several reasons. Obviously, we lost a champion in equal rights for African Americans, women, and just people in the shadows in general. He was a major voice. Not only was he a voice, but he was, as Martin Luther King called, a drum major for justice. He talked a talk and walked a walk. And when I say walked a walk, I remember when the Freddie Gray events happened. And I often see politicians who walk away from the citizens. And here we have Elijah Cummings, Congressman Elijah Cummings, talking to the youth that we were told in the media to be afraid of. And the way I found out was really, really bizarre. Let me just preface it. I was in Washington, D.C. for the CAP for a couple of days. And before that, I drove from Columbus, Ohio, from the presidential debates, 4 o'clock in the morning. So I haven't had a lot of sleep. So my girlfriend, who I forgot was staying in the room with me, yells out at 5:20 in the morning. I'm still asleep. Elijah Cummings has passed. So I'm looking around. I'm like, I forgot where I was. And I just was like, okay, I'm in a dream. That didn't happen. And so the first thing I did was I had to confirm with three different sources. And it was true. And I tell you, all of yesterday was humbling because I was surrounded by his peers. I was at a women's leadership conference, and the majority of the speakers were women, female House of Representatives and members. And for dinner, I had a member at my table, Congresswoman Grace Meng, and to hear not just House members, but also senators like Senator Warren talk about her relationship with him, and Tom Perez choking up at the microphone. And it was just really, really, really tough. But I was in the right place to grieve with them because, you know, we lost a champion.
Mm-hmm. Paul?
I think the few times that I have seen him publicly, I guess, and on TV and in the news, Michelle said is right. It seems like he was that connective tissue and that glue that kept everyone together. And I mean, obviously, I was doing some research on him the last couple of days, and he's had an incredible career. But even more than that is the people across the aisle that have talked about their friendships with him, and the people in Baltimore, across Maryland, that talked about these different times, whether it's the Freddie Gray's murder, or even the recent spat that happened in Congress between Mark Meadows and a freshman Democrat. And by the next day, Elijah Cummings had them embracing each other on TV for the world to see. And that kind of leadership and camaraderie and understanding that we're all in this together is something that I hope we can all emulate.
It's such a rare quality in a person, let alone a politician. What do you think, Robert?
Yeah, so first I was, I was also like others here, shocked. We share the same fraternity, Phi Beta Sigma Fraternity Incorporated, and he represents everything we want to be. And so when you look at that, that's important. He, again, as it was already said earlier, there were people on both sides of the aisle who had great things to say about him, and that tells you about the life he lived. And there was a congressman, I can't think of his name right now, who is a Republican, who told a story about how they were all in a room debating, and everyone seemed no end to the debating and no end to the squabbling. And then the congressman said, "Listen, are we done?" And the whole room stopped. He stopped the room, and they reached a consensus. And it was the congressman that sort of rallied everybody to say, "All right, this is what we have to be thinking about. This is why we're talking about the issues we're talking about." And so when you look at that, that's important. I'll also say that he was a leader since undergrad at Howard University, right? Served in the student government. And to Tiana's earlier point, he never got a chance to retire. So when you look at Black leadership, there's that weight of having to do everything. And so that's one of the things I wish that he had that chance to sort of, you know, take a deep breath, and he never had that chance.
You know, I think about that weight, another weight that I think oftentimes Black leadership has, and that he was like obviously a strong example of, I mean, stronger than many other leaders, was that weight of reaching out to the other side and having to do that when the other side wouldn't necessarily reach out and have that same relationship with you. I mean, Trey Gowdy had wrote this amazing piece, which I disagree with Trey Gowdy on most things, but about his friendship and with the congressman, and, you know, Mark Meadows also had, and other Republicans, but especially that Gowdy piece was, you know, really amazing. But I think that's a burden oftentimes that Black leaders have, you know, locally, statewide, you know, nationwide, where it's having to do that extra outreach to the side and try to build that personal relationship so they can see you and your constituents as human. And then from there, try to talk about the policy discussions that, you know, oftentimes, you know, people on the other side don't understand. And he obviously, I think more than most, took that burden upon him to make that effort to make those relationships, those personal relationships, so he could help move policy, and that's an extra weight just on top of being an elected official.
He made some comments about issues related to that after President Trump called him a racist, and this came after the controversy surrounding President Trump's comments about Baltimore. He called it a rodent-infested mess where, quote, no human being would want to live, end quote. And Representative Cummings called on the president to help majority black cities address the problems with poverty and crime rather than just trash it. And the president continued to make his comments. And then, according to the Baltimore Sun, Congressman Cummings said, quote, I don't think these Republicans or Trump fully understand what it feels like to be treated like less than a dog. I'm feeling the same things that I felt when these white folks down in South Baltimore were throwing rocks and bottles at me. But now I feel like it's the president of the United States doing it. So he wasn't afraid to speak out, and he wasn't afraid to walk across the aisle. And as all of you have said, and as the media has reported, words like grace, connective tissue, a bridge, just common across all of these reports that we're seeing. Mayor Bill Johnson wanted to weigh in on this conversation. He wasn't able to join us in person, but he sent a statement that I can read, and he said, quote, I loved that man for his eloquent defense of the invisible and voiceless people and his fearless confrontation of despots and bullies. One of my favorite quotes describes him to a T. He comforted the afflicted, the comfortable. And yet he fought for bipartisan and biracial collaboration. There are not many people with his style and substance in leadership today. And I think that's so powerful. And I know all of you have expressed similar comments. How rare is that in politicians these days? Are we seeing anyone else who rises to that level, in your opinion?
It's funny. I was seeing a lot of reporters talking yesterday or the last couple of days, especially younger black reporters, and they talked about how he helped them. And oftentimes, you know, the press is seen as adversarial, especially, you know, like you're in a capital like Albany or D.C., but the fact that all these reporters from when he was in the State House to being in Congress talked about how you would take them aside and, like, this is the hearing room you want to go to, or this is how that process works. And I think if you do that and if leaders do that, you know, you have a more informed press, which means people that still read the papers or watch the news are better informed. And I think that's something he understood. But that is increasingly rare. I think there's obviously a lot more, you know, when it comes to dealing with the press, distrust, you know, on both sides and lack of full disclosure of or wanting to help, you know, understand where you're coming from. And I mean, he was somebody, again, who was, I think, realized that was not helpful for trying to get issues talked about and get people to do an understanding. But I just remember it was interesting watching those reporters talk, and a lot of them just have personal stories of him, you know, giving them some insight.
I'm going to be negative and say that I don't see anyone like him. I see people that are close. And what I'm trying to say is and I have not picked, I'm undecided as far as the presidential candidates, but people like Amy Klobuchar and Cory Booker, they have expressed to go ahead and reach out and work with the other side, and Amy Klobuchar has actually done that. But my issues with temperament, like just watching Cummings in the hearings when Daryl Issa was, you know, the chairman of the oversight, and he wouldn't let Cummings speak. I mean, like, he literally would rob his voice, shutting off the mic. And then when Cummings was now the chair, he wasn't turning off any mics. They would literally talk over him, and he was in charge. And they would tell him how to do his job, even though he has been in the office. At that point, it was like 21 years, that office. Before that, he was a judge. Before that, he was a lawyer. This is a man who was born in South Carolina, a son of sharecroppers. And he worked that hard, and to see how people would talk to him as if he was a boy was problematic to me. And I know that if I was in that same position, I would probably shut off mics when they spoke and I was in power. But he had the grace and humility to do unto others as he would like to have done. And I think that that is what is missing in politics today.
How important is it to have a role model like him? In 2019 especially, Tiana, you said this is living history that we've now lost. And when you think about what's being taught in schools, I hope that schools will teach his legacy. but what does it mean? Let's talk about that, Tiana.
I think we already do a pretty bad job of teaching 200-year-old Black history.
Absolutely.
I can't imagine we're even close to catching up on that. But I would hope so.
Was there somebody after Martin Luther King? What?
Right, maybe. There was something after that.
I'm not laughing at the concept. It's just so
bad.
Ridiculous mm-hmm. that it's...
You almost have to laugh or you're going to go crazy. But I would say overall, I think, you know, he was somebody who really embodied that grace. And I think what's really powerful is that he did it in the face of some of the least graceful people that this world has ever seen. And I think to some extent, it's going right back to that idea of retiring. I mean, even within his role, he was never treated with that respect so that, not that the job gets easier, but that it comes with the respect that he deserves. And so he was literally scrapping until the very end. There's this popular story out where, you know, he was signing all of these different documents on his deathbed. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, even in his last few moments, he didn't know that piece. And so I do hope that if we teach his legacy, that we discuss, you know, it does take a lot of work, but we also have to discuss building in places of, I don't know, I guess comfort for each other. That 68-year-old fight, I mean, he is so young. Biden is older than him and running for president. It does something to the body, and I think about that all the time with our Black politicians.
Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking that I was sharing a tweet that he wrote a couple of months ago. And it was saying that when the history books is written, he wants to be remembered that he stood up against lawlessness and tyranny, talking about the current administration and what's going on. And it reminded me of the project that Nicole Hannah-Jones is doing right now with the New York Times, the 1619 Project, where she's saying that this country was not a democracy until Black Americans made it one. And I don't know, just all these thoughts are running through my head of him... of all the fight that he's been through and all the struggles that he's had to deal with, and why does he still care? Why does he still love this country? And why does he still have that grace and that compassion to others when you're right, when Michelle is right? He should be a little bit more upset. Maybe he something in him wants to turn off that mic, but he decided that this the overall mission is more important, and he cares and loves the country and wants to see it succeed to the point where he is willing to sacrifice his life and his body to make it a better country.
Mm-hmm. Robert, did you want to weigh in?
Yeah, so yes, I'm admired by his grace, and he had that grace. But he also realized that there are some people across that aisle that you cannot work with. And that's why you saw that juxtaposition between him thinking about the civil rights movement and juxtaposing that with Donald Trump. When you look at, we pretty much have built Bull Connor in the White House, right? And when you look at the racist, the xenophobic, just go all of the through all of the isms. When you see how President Trump embodies that and has seen that in America, and his him seeing that existence in America allows him to be president, right? And the further he divides us allows him to have, and people don't want to think about it, him to have a second term. And so when you think about that, there are some people like President Trump who we cannot work with, and we have to fight every day. And so although he had that grace, he also said there's some people that we're not going to work with.
And I think that what he was really good at, and not all politicians are good at this, and oftentimes there's too many spokespeople for the Democratic Party, including African-American ones, who aren't as good as Cummings was at being very clear, and like the clarity with how he spoke against Trump. Where if you could be somebody, a white person watching this and not thinking, oh, there's this Black politician just saying this because he's Black. No, like the words and what he used were American values coming through this African-American man with this history, which he also infused his words with. But just the way that it was just so clear. And I didn't even recognize it until I just saw other people, you know, railing against Trump. And I was like, oh, why can't you do it more like Cummings? He was so much with the clarity and the words he used and, I don't know if he was an amazing writer or had good writers on staff or, you know, was a good editor or whatever. But, you know, that clarity when he spoke about these injustices, I just think that was, very much needed and something that's lacking.
I want to go back to a comment you made, Michelle, about all the adversity he faced. growing up, not only growing up, but in his adult life, he was told by a school counselor when he was very young that he was too slow a learner and too poor a speaker to ever become a lawyer. And he said he was devastated. And he said from that point on, this became, I should quote him correctly, but from that point on, his life had changed and he dedicated himself to that goal. And it reminds me, not only any child, unfortunately, can hear something like that from a counselor, from a teacher. I'm sure we've all had moments in our lives. But mm-hmm. then to have to overcome the hurdles that African Americans have to overcome just in daily life in general, this must have been a massive undertaking for him, both on a personal level and a professional level.
Yeah, well, I think that there were two things that helped him move forward. You know, even though his parents were sharecroppers, one of the things that his father instilled in him since he was younger was success is not measured by what you have or do. It's what you do for those that are in the shadows. And the other thing that really, really kept him going was his faith. I wanted to mentioned something that Tom Perez said last night. He said that he was a Matthew 25 politician. And if you look at all the different things that he has done with, like the immigration detention centers and the homeless, and just in general, he talked about when I was naked, you clothed me. When I was homeless, you housed me. When I was an immigrant, you welcomed me. When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was jail, you visited me. And if you just look at his career, not just as a politician, but, you know, also as a lawyer, he has dedicated his life to giving back to those who were in the shadows. So I think that that was his major drive, people who were voiceless. And he himself, even as an adult, like I just said, Daryl Issa cutting his microphone, that was just so symbolic of what he represented. Even though you cut my mic, I'm going to talk louder.
Mm-hmm. If I can just add in, I think sometimes too, when we discuss this legacy, it's the perfect time to criticize the system as well, because I don't think, you know, Representative Cummings is in heaven like, oh, I hope they talk about my grace forever. Yes, we want individuals to embody that grace, but we also want to create a system where that grace isn't necessary. Mm-hmm. And so I think even when we discuss them, okay, when we discuss these people, we like to talk about these strong, amazing people as if there aren't thousands of other black and brown bodies that have been chewed up by the system. And so the same grace that Elijah Cummings has, it's unique, but only because we exist in this crappy system. I think if we were to look at these other, you know, the same things that he fought, all of these different issues, we could have a lot more of these Elijah Cummings coming out if we didn't stop them when they were how old, 9, 10, 11, and say, you're too poor of a speaker.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I think all of you in this room represent that. And I'm hoping that the collective body of people that are working to change the system can all lift each other up. But you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, we're remembering someone, we're talking about a legacy, but you're right. Let's not forget about the underlying systems.
The crap that he was fighting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What do you think, you know, looking back on him in even 5 years from now, but let's go a little further out, let's say 10, 15, what do you think the major point or the major issue will be when people consider him? What's the fight that they will think of?
I think they'll go back to his statement. I should have brought this that quote, but he was like, history's going to look back on us and say, what did you do to defend our democracy in 2019? You know, and you see, you know, these silent Republican senators, even, I don't know what's happened in the last 3 hours, probably something else crazy the president has done, or right now as we speak, or his staff. So I think when he was very direct about this being a historic time and speaking up, and what side were you on? And he said, like, when the angels are dancing in heaven with you, what, you know, what are they going to say in regards to what did you do this year in 2019 to speak up and to fight back? And like you said, 10 years from now, you know, assuming our democracy has survived, you know, people are looking back and, okay, who did what? You know, who's apologetic now and was apologetic then? And I think that statement he says is going to be one of those things that are going to be brought up. Well, remember what Cummings said? Who fell on what side? And it's going to be like, You know, it'll be, I think that's going to be, and I don't think he'd want that to be his legacy, unfortunately. I think that would be. I mean, I think he'd rather talk about the bills he sponsored and the legislation that he pushed and the examples he set and things he fought for when he was in the state legislature and, you know, actions that he did, you know, before Trump and, you know, when he was in Congress. I think that he'd want that to be more talked about because that was the work, that was his life's work. But if you're asking, I mean, I think, unfortunately, that prism of where we're going to be in 10 years from now and looking back about Cummings, that's what he's going to be known for, Brett.
And if I can disagree just slightly, yeah. I think he may want to be remembered for being the voice of the critic. I was doing some research on him, and he had this quote that there are all these statues in Baltimore. So Baltimore actually, I believe, has the highest number of statues out of any city. And he was saying that there are all these statues from the people that were criticized, and where are all the statues from the critics? These are all the people that were powerful, that were a ton of Confederate monuments. There are all these statues and monuments all over. And I think he did relish that role of being that critic, of being that mirror to show America, this is really what you look like. This is really, I know you have these great words written down on paper, but this is really what you look like.
I think what I'm thinking more so is, I'm looking at, like, I read some of the obituaries, and the beginning of the obituary is a critic of Trump. And he was much more than that.
Yes.
Like, you know, if he had died 2 years ago, there have been many things that could have been written about him that had nothing to do with President Trump. So it's like, I mean, I'm sure there were obituaries that didn't start off his first line as, or first paragraph as a critic of Trump and Trump being a part of that story, of his story. So I think that's more so what I'm like, yes, you know, him being a critic of the system, but it was more than just about, you know, this current disaster we have in the White House.
Well, Larry, I absolutely adore you, and it's very rare that I disagree with you, but I think...
Oh, two.
I'm sorry.
So, Robertine, I need some backup.
I think that the quote, and I will read the quote that you were talking about, is going to be a major part of his legacy. One, because he spoke of angels in 2019, and he is an angel in 2019. But to me, it was also a call to action. The quote is, when we are dancing with the angels in 2019, what did we do to make sure we kept our democracy intact? Did we stand on the sidelines and say nothing? So I think that's a bipartisan quote. That's also a call to Democrats that have sat idle. What are we going to do to keep our democracy intact? And another thing that I think is going to be part of his legacy, And I said that, you know, he does fight for equality. He was an egalitarian, but it wasn't necessarily that he wanted to see everyone equal. He wanted to make sure that everybody had an equal chance to do well in this country. If he can do it, anyone can. And that's what I get from him as a person, not necessarily as a politician. I look at his whole body of work, and, you know, if you look at where he's from, Baltimore, the home of Frederick Douglass, well, you know, Rochester is the actual home, but, you know, Frederick Douglass spent a lot of time there. And, you know, he was a pupil of history and fight and an agitator like Douglass. So, you know, I look at his whole body of work, and his legacy is that he's calling us to action. On Friday, I know for a fact that this was probably the biggest phone conference ever, but 200 of the House members were on the phone and speaking with him to get guidelines. They knew it was coming. They didn't realize it was this soon, but there was a sense of urgency to get 200 people on a phone, and he took the call. Wow. He was calling us to action.
Paul, I know you wanted to weigh in. Oh, I'm sorry, Robert.
Yeah, but to Paul's earlier point about the congressman wanted to be remembered as a fighter against tyranny and lawlessness. And although it's bigger than Trump, Trump is that latest iteration of lawlessness, right? And we have a criminal in the White House. He broke laws on the campaign trail. And there's a book by David Fahrenthold called Uncovering Trump, The Truth Behind Donald Trump's Charitable Giving.
Washington Post reporter. Yeah.
Yes, Washington Post reporter, right? On the campaign trail, he's breaking almost all of the charitable giving laws there is. When you have, right, the articles of impeachment coming and so many things that are happening, and you see this latest iteration of lawlessness, we need someone to fight for the issues. And yes, it's bigger than Trump, but we need someone to fight as hard as Trump is fighting for his basic issues, to fight for the issues that says something about America, right? To be anti-racist, to fight against sexism, to fight against homophobia, and so on and so on and so on. And so, yes, it's bigger than Trump. But that just shows how he fought the latest iteration of lawlessness and tyranny.
I have some questions for our guests about working with the other side and when not to work with someone, as I think it was you brought up earlier, Robert. And that's in relation to some conversations that have been happening locally. And we can avoid names if you'd like, but there are some issues that I think are pertinent to this conversation. So when we come back from our very short break, we'll hear more from Larry Knox, Michelle Daniels, Paul Hippolyte, Tiana Mannion, and Robert Hoggard about the legacy of Congressman Elijah Cummings. More Connections next. Coming up in our second hour, we explore the Landmark Society of Western New York's 2019 Five to Revive list. It's a list of five historic spaces or buildings in our area that the Society thinks could improve surrounding neighborhoods if they were revitalized. We'll talk about buildings, we'll talk about a thematic listing, the adaptive reuse of historic houses of worship. That and much more coming up next. You're listening to Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. Joining me in studio talking about the legacy of Congressman Elijah Cummings, Larry Knox, Political and Community Engagement Coordinator for 1199 SEIU, Michelle Daniels, Super Democratic Volunteer, Paul Hippolyte, a political strategist, Tiana Mannion, publicist, journalist, and political analyst, and Robert Hoggard, doctoral student at the Warner School of Education and Development Associate at Rochester Regional Health. As I mentioned before our break, I have some questions for our guests about when it's appropriate to, in their opinion, not work with the other side, when it's appropriate to try very hard to go across the aisle, as Congressman Cummings did. And I bring this up because in recent conversations we've had on this program related to elected offices, we've talked to candidates for Rochester City Council. One of those candidates is an African-American man who is a Republican. I asked him on this program if he thinks President Trump is racist, and he said no. And I asked him why, and he said because he thinks the president is so self-centered that he's not working against one particular group. He's in it for himself. I should have pulled the quotes from candidate Marcus Williams, but I don't have it with me. But that was, I'm paraphrasing a bit, but he said he is, you know, working for his own ambitions. It doesn't matter if you're white, black, Hispanic, Asian. It doesn't matter to him. And I'd just like to ask our panelists what they think of those comments. I'll start with you, Paul.
Oh, me.
You know what? I'm going to be generous to him. There's a nugget of truth in there that Trump is for himself. And he will step over anyone. He'll step over his own kids if they were got in the way. I think just recently he looks like he's not sure anymore if Giuliani is really his lawyer or not. Now that Giuliani's in trouble. What's his name? Mark Cohen. Once he got into trouble, he all of a sudden didn't know him. So he is in it for himself. That doesn't mean that you're then not sexist or not racist, but it is, he is correct in that sense that Trump is in it for himself.
Okay. Robert.
Oh, I would have to not be generous and say, listen, that the people who, when you look at the people who Trump has attacked, Maxine Waters, and the list just goes on and on, and Muslim Congress women and men. When you just look at all of the lists of people who he's personally attacked, if Trump isn't a racist, then who is? You know, I'm not gonna stand for that. And you just have to look at Trump's body of work. And the policies that he advocates for, and how he's caught, when you look at the immigration issue, on how he's deported so many people and wants to call Latinos criminals and so on and so on. It's just like, no, that's something that we can't play. We can't play pity pat with that. And so I would disagree with Marcus Williams on that.
Tiana, when we talk about working across the aisle, as Congressman Cummings did, is there a point at which you should stop, do you think? Are there certain people with which you should not collaborate?
I think it comes at when it's at the cost of your humanity. I think when you have to literally argue why you deserve these very basic human rights, it's time to stop fighting that politician and fight the system that created them. Understand whatever went into creating this politician themselves, but also the voting laws, the different, we talk about gerrymandering all the time, all of these different things that play a part in how these people get into office. So obviously in a two-party system, you have no choice but to work with the other side. I think it can get worse and worse as each side tries to bully each other. But I do also think we're hitting kind of an intersection where we have to ask ourselves, at what point are we going to, stop putting our resources into these conversations and have, cut the tree down at the root instead of just fighting all the berries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a ridiculous, uninformed, and stupid thing for him to say. The first time Donald Trump ever appeared in the newspaper in the 1970s was because him and his dad's company was discriminating against African-Americans in regards to housing and renting. There's been plenty of lawsuits. There's been plenty of examples. The Central Park case where he asked for the execution of those kids who were, criminally charged with the rape that they didn't commit with DNA evidence. And after the DNA evidence came out, he still, was saying, said they were still guilty of those rapes. The fact that he supported up until the very end and Steve King, the Iowa congressman, who was even, disarmed and pushed out of his own party because of his really, really overt racism. And there's enough overt racism, but his was too much. And, the president have any problem with him. The fact that he's hired racists who've worked for him. A lot of racists and white nationalists seem to somehow end up working in that administration, in lower roles sometimes. Then once they get discovered because of things that they had said that come out, they get let go, they get moved. But it seems like to be a very high amount. I mean, people sneak in sometimes, but he has a very high amount of people that affiliate with his campaign that, that want to support him. David Duke has oftentimes said that, he's agreeing with things that the president had said. And all of a sudden, when the president was asked about David Duke, he didn't know who he was, I don't know how you don't know who he is. Charlottesville, there's good people on both sides. I mean, and I have a list of 50 other things in my head that are over obvious racial statements. Even his, when he sees a black person, they're kind of, oh, look, there's my black over there who supports me. The way his language is shows that he doesn't have an understanding or friends or dealings or a comprehension that the majority of Americans, Democrat, Republican, whatever race, whatever party, have with other people's, have with people of different, backgrounds. Obviously, that's something, he's missing a lot of things, emotionally, mentally, spiritually, but obviously, having deep relationships with African Americans, Hispanics, anybody that's not like him is something that's sorely lacking. And on top of all that, he is obviously racist. And maybe he feels himself he isn't racist. I could honestly believe that. But his actions, his thoughts, his remarks, his dealings with people, in personal situations, I don't see how you can think that he isn't racist.
Well, a lot of people pretty much have said what I was thinking, so I don't have much. But if you look at the citizenships that have passed throughout his term, which ones are people of color and which ones are coming from European countries. So that's one major indicator.
It's like asshole comment, too. That goes
So it's just like, I'm like, if you say, I can't judge the person's heart, you go by the facts. And then I'm going to quote Mayor Gillum. He says, I'm not saying he's a racist, but the racists think he's a racist. And that's where I feel.
Yeah.
We have some questions coming in and comments coming in from our listeners. If you'd like to join the program, you can call 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program at connections@WXXI.org. And you can find me on Twitter at MMacMedia. Here's a comment from a listener named Rob. He says, Congressman Cummings was the lion's roar for what was right and just. He always knew when to raise his voice, but still had the grace and temperament to get the job done. That's from Rob. We talked during our very short break about concerns about sanitizing his reputation. That's something you brought up, Tiana, sanitizing his legacy. When people pass away, there's sometimes a tendency to use hagiography. We treat them as saints. We're all humans. We all have our issues and our made mistakes. But talk a little bit about that, Tiana. I know that when we look back on him.
I think the perfect case is Dr. Martin Luther King.
For sure.
We love sanitizing his legacy. We don't even talk about his anti-war, his ideas on the class war. We don't mention any of that. We don't even talk about the night he was assassinated, what he was doing in Memphis.
We do all the time as a union
member. Okay, yes, you do.
A union strike, yes.
Yes, yes, he was. And so my fear is that this brave, brave stalwart who stood up against so many big things, homelessness, he literally just was working on legislation with Elizabeth Warren to get cities way more funding for opioid issues. And so my concern is that when we look at the big things that we were fighting for, we're only ever going to talk about his grace. And he was so nice and how hard he fought. But we're not going to talk about the systems that he fought against and how we're still fighting against these systems. So I would say that if we're going to talk about his legacy going forward and we're going to make sure it's not sanitized, we really have to couch it in understanding the systems he's fighting against, yeah, how long he's been fighting against them, and how long we will fight against them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Michelle? Oh, it looks like you had a lot to say. Well, you all have a lot
to
say.
I'm agreeing with Tiana.
And why is Baltimore a poor, downtrodden, let's use Trump's words, rodent-infested city? That
Get
didn't happen by mistake. It didn't happen on its own. We can talk about redlining. We can talk about housing policies. I know we talked about that the last time Larry and I were on the show. These are decisions that the state and federal government have made over decades, mm-hmm, that we need an Elijah Cummings.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to talk about representation in government, because the numbers, although there's an upward trend, there's a significant underrepresentation, of course, of people of color in government. This is data from Pew Research Center. Says data from the past 50 years reveal the upward yet uneven trajectory of black political leadership in America. In 1965, there were no blacks in the U.S. Senate, nor were there any black governors. 1965, no black representatives in the Senate, no African-American governors. And only 6 members of the House of Representatives were black. As of 2019, there is greater representation in some areas. 52 House members are black, putting the share of black House members on par with the share of blacks in the U.S. population overall for the first time in history. But in other areas, there has been little change. Those numbers, I don't like the tendency to just talk about statistics, because we're talking about systems, we're talking about humans that are being represented, citizens and communities. How do you feel about the change in those numbers, Robert?
Yeah, I think you've seen some progress in those change in numbers. But when you look at diversity and inclusion, diversity, I forgot who said it, but diversity is being invited to the party, but inclusion is actually being invited to dance. And so although you've seen the progress of us being invited to the party, you're really not seeing yet that inclusive, right, where we see policies that are specifically designed for people of color. And although you see some people of color running for president, you don't see them talking about specific policies that are catered to lifting black people up, right? When you see the only person who was touting reparations was Marianne Williamson, Cory Booker and Kamala Harris weren't even talking about it. And so
Beto talked about it. Beto O'Rourke didn't
talk about
it.
He did. Although I think he won't win. But
neither will Marianne Williamson.
No, she won't either.
I'll say that's why it's important for, like, my union, SEIU 1199, we've been bringing in the candidates. There's a big forum we had a couple weeks ago in California, and those are issues that our members are talking to them about. But we're, you know, and with the union movement under attack, it's harder and harder. But our union, being one of the few growing unions, has been able to put people in a position to challenge the candidates and have them answer those kind of questions. But that's kind of unique. I mean, that's not something that they're always going to get. Obviously, it's something that, you know, our union was a strong supporter of the congressmen in Maryland, and we would have members that would ask those kind of questions and get that kind of engagement from him. And we're doing that with the presidential candidates. But I think it could be lost that what Tiana's talking about, that system. Our union has fought and endorsed Democrats and Republicans if they support our issue set. And if you're not for our issue set, which is helping out, you know, our members who are trying to get, you know, to self-sufficiency and trying to take care of their families and want to have, you know, good jobs and good care and be able to take good care of their patients, we're going to be fighting the same fight for 10 years. And individualizing the person as opposed to the system is a danger. I mean, I'm not sure in 1981 who our, you know, our union was endorsing and doing what and here in Rochester or in Buffalo, but I know what the issue set was. I know what the system they were trying to fight. And that's the same thing now. And I think that point is kind of lost. And unless you have institutions that are able, and advocacy groups, you know, that are able to fight and bring those things up and hold those electeds accountable and other community leaders accountable, we're going to be in the same spot.
As a woman of color, I am proud and embarrassed at the same time at the fact that we are starting to celebrate more firsts. Okay. We have been a nation for a very long time. And in the last swearing in that I went to in January, I saw the first two Native American women become congresswomen for the first time. And I had a chance to talk to Deb Hallon yesterday and Sharice Davids, and I just gave them a big hug. And I don't think they understood what that meant to me, but the fact that they were the indigenous people here and we're just celebrating their first is a total embarrassment. I also spoke to Congresswoman Johanna Hayes, the first African-American woman to be a congresswoman in Connecticut. That's the Northeast. This should be easy. This is a blue state. So, you know, the fact that we're celebrating first, of course I'm going to celebrate it, but I am embarrassed because it's long overdue.
Mm-hmm. Obama won. Wouldn't that take care of all that?
We're in a post-racial society, right?
Let's
people
head to
on
the
good sides, both sides.
Let's head to the phones. Up first is David in Aurora. Go ahead, David.
Hi. It's great to hear this. I heard on NPR the other day about how Mr. Cummins was class president, I believe, in a segregated high school, if I had that right. And the other thing I wanted to talk about was a poem that he frequently read nearly every day of his adult life, dealing with the shortness of time, which they also talked about on this NPR. In fact, they read the poem and it laid it out into a minute's time and how short life was. And given the fact that he was 68 when he died, and I'm now 74, and a white guy, I guess I could ask, it was interesting to hear how much he respected how short life was.
Thank you, David. Thanks for that call. I'm not familiar with that poem, but we can certainly link to it on our website when I post the podcast page for this broadcast. So thanks, David. Thanks for calling with that. In our last few minutes, I know that we've covered a lot of ground, but I'll just ask a very open question to our guests because this is your hour. What have we missed? What have we not discussed about Congressman Cummins that maybe the general public didn't know, that they're not reading in media reports, that they're not seeing on television right now? You're all very involved politically or in journalism locally, so I think you have more insight than maybe many of us do. What's a takeaway for you? I'll start with you, Larry.
I'm thinking back to when Angela Davis came to Rochester the day after Trump got was elected, and she was at East High, and she gave amazing speech. But one of the things she talked about was self-care for activists, and mainly for activists, was the same for elected officials. And me being in that field is something that I've tried to get better at. And she talked about mental and spiritual and physical self-care. Just the fact that this work is draining and hard. If you're just a volunteer doing some volunteering on a campaign, let alone being an elected official, or let alone being an activist who's doing that full time. And obviously, I don't know his full circumstances of his physical health, but I'm sure, if he had been, a teacher or just a lawyer, he might still be alive right now. And there's a lot of elected officials, a lot of activists. And just what Angela Davis was talking about, taking care of yourself. She got into yoga in the 70s, because she realized that was something that was going to help her be healthier and longer. So just to think that the literal physical and mental and emotional and spiritual toll of fighting these fights and doing these battles, it's not literal boxing or being an athlete, but there is a toll that people may not understand. And I've seen it, and there's a toll in relationships also often that I've seen for people that are in activism and in politics that is often understated. And I don't know if that played a part in his health, but I think that's something that we should be aware of and think about.
We haven't even addressed the trauma that comes generationally, post-traumatic slave syndrome and issues related to that. We could do a whole separate hour, but I think that's something to keep in mind. Tiana, what's your takeaway?
I'll try and keep mine short. I guess every time you think about the representative and you, I would prefer that you think of, sorry, Rob. I would prefer
former radio reporter.
I know. I should know better. I would just say every time you think about the representative, think more about what he was fighting for and not how he fought. It is so easy to get kind of stuck in that personality, this is how you should act, that we forget the work we still have to do. So I would say really focus on that every time you really think about his legacy.
Robert.
There were great things already said, but I'll piggyback from what Larry said and say, you know, we really have to talk about the trauma associated with Black leaders and how he died at 68. And the complications behind that. Michael Eric Dyson wrote in one of his books that when you look at Dr. King, although he died in his 30s, he had a heart of a 50-something-year-old. Mm. Mm. Right? So when you think about the pressure that we put on Black leaders who fight for justice, and although America's in many ways does embrace Black leaders, the pressure that it takes for us to sort of push the envelope is something we need to think about.
Paul.
Elijah Cummings is part of a long history of Black leaders and lawyers who have fought for justice. I was thinking of Charles Hamilton Houston, who's the first Black editor of the Harvard Law Review. He then went on to become the dean of the law school at Howard University, and a lot of people credited him with coming up with the strategy that the NAACP used to fight a lot of discrimination laws and segregation laws. And he said that a lawyer is either a social engineer or a parasite on society. And I think we all can recognize Elijah Cummings' work as a real social engineer for justice.
Thank you. Michelle.
I just wanted to, I know we're short on time, so I just wanted to make sure that we acknowledge Maya, his wife, his children, and his family, colleagues and friends and people affected by his passing. I feel your pain,
and I'm
praying for you.
Thank you. Thank you. And listeners, thanks for joining us for this important discussion. Our thanks to Larry Knox, Michelle Daniels, Paul Hippolyte, Tiana Manio, and Robert Hoggard. I appreciate you all being here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Short break. More Connections next.